Hi, everybody. I'm Eric with a K from Burbank. Ever grateful, Al-Anonic. That's me. It's a real honor to be asked to speak anywhere. Before my recovery, they were done listening to me. So opportunities where people actually want to hear what I have to say. That recovery has brought that kind of change and experience in my life. So I want to thank Tracy and her husband, Pat, for inviting me here and being so welcoming and kind. I've been to this neck of the woods over the last 3 years a lot. COVID was a very isolating experience, I'm sure, for all of us. And for me, in the heart of Los Angeles, you know, where there were weeks where they wouldn't even allow us to walk in our neighborhoods. I suffer from a disease that would have me isolate. And when I isolate, I do what I'm best at. Guess what that is? I hurt. I'm really good at that. And so I would need to get away. And so I'd jump in my car and I'd come out and explore the 14, everything along it, and everything along the 395. And I found that nature itself doesn't have COVID. And but it is contagious. And I like the feeling I had when I came here. And the desert is full of a kind of beauty that I think I, as an Al-Anonic, can really appreciate. And that is, you know, you grow up the way I did in a pretty tough alcoholic sort of home setting. You learn, you get it, you got to be tough and hardy if you're going to survive. And so if you look around the desert, you will see tough and hardy things that don't just survive, they live. And they're beautiful. And so to me, it feels like the desert reflects back at me the way I am and have become. And so I love this place. I want to thank previous speakers who've gone before me. You got Joe from Bishop, who talked about, you know, honesty. And I thought to myself, you know, he talked a lot about wielding axes. And in my home group, the La Cañada Men's Stag meeting called the 7 o'clock Let's Rock Al-Anon Family Group. And it's the best damn Al-Anon meeting in the world. And if you don't feel that way about your meeting, well, go find another one, you know. In my home group, we use a lot of nicknames. And some of my nicknames they've given me was, first one was simple, too many Erics around, but there was only one with a K, so they called me Eric with a K. And then I broke my Achilles, and I had to walk around after, you know, doing all that stuff. I ended up walking around with a cane. So one of them changed Eric with a K to Eric with a cane. And when I no longer needed the cane, and I thought that nickname would go away, they just changed it to Eric without the cane. And, you know, we have a lot of fun in program around nicknames. And so I was thinking of some nicknames for Joe, and the one I think that stuck best, and if you throw axes, that's a joke there, but the nickname I would give him is Axe Me a Question Joe. Because axe is just such a big part, you know, of his recovery. So, and then there's Rebecca, who very beautifully talked about hope. You know, most of us, when we come into Al-Anon, have none, or less than none, and it's amazing that we make it. And, you know, she talked about, the thing I related most to her was that mixtape she talked about, you know, the dark and depressing one. And she said there were two artists on there. I knew I guessed one of them right. It was The Cure. And the other one was, which one was it again? Yeah, Pink Floyd. And I was like, oh, we could have swapped, you know, mixtapes when we were a kid. And so my nickname for Rebecca is just Mixtape Rebecca. That's how I'll remember you. And Heather's talk. How many of you were here for that? Holy cow. Wasn't that amazing? She said that, you know, she's the wild and crazy part of her still in recovery, and I love that. I love that. Because our lives are supposed to get big. You know? Yeah, we wanted to live big when we were sick. Didn't have a very good job at that, but in recovery we learned how to do it. And I love that she brings her karaoke machine to different places just to keep things going. And what she doesn't know, and I'll say it now, is I have one too, and I'm not an alcoholic. And it's like, and the guys, you know, that I've got two of my dearest friends from my home group that are here. And they honor me by being here. I thank you for that. They've come to some of these offsites that our men's stag meeting does. We go out to different places, and we have our retreats that we can't call retreats, so we call them offsites. And at those offsites, sometimes we'd have guys that will play music on instruments like guitars or harmonicas or whatever they can get their hands on. But the last time we did it, we did karaoke, didn't we? And if you want to see a sight, watch a bunch of hide in the corner Al-Anons, right? Those type of people do karaoke. Because you've just given them permission to let their wild side out. And they do have it. They do have it. It's just amazing. And then the songs they pick, it's amazing how alcoholic or Al-Anonic the songs they pick are. You know? Burn, burn, burn. You know? Like, yeah, they're the best. They're the best. So anyway, I thought my nickname for Heather would have to be Karaoke Heather. So, just remind me of just how much they bring life back into our lives and things like that. So, my topic today, of course, has to do with really the fourth and fifth step, and it's about having courage and integrity. Now, for those of you who built this program, it's not lost on me that the last three speakers only had one topic, and now you're giving me two. Do you think Al-Anons can carry more weight still? Is that what's going on here? And then I realized, when I looked at the rest of the steps, all the rest of the AA speakers are going to also have two topics. So I was like, all right, I guess I'm not terminally unique anymore. But it was like... So when I'll tell a bit of my story so you can kind of understand where I'm coming from. Why do I qualify for Al-Anon? All that kind of stuff. But I want to get into, since this is my topic, you know, has to do with those principles of step four and five. I want to talk about, as a sponsor, what you can do to help people that usually get to that fourth and fifth step, and that's usually where they kick away, how to retain them. How to help them finish it. Because that's usually they start at that and then they fold under the pressure of the Mount Everest that's before them. That's the way it looks to them. And so I'll spend a little bit of time talking about that. But first I'll just begin by telling you a little bit about me. And, you know, so I grew up as an only child in a family of 14 siblings. That's isolation kicked off right at the beginning. So, and the nicknames they gave in our family were all alcoholic. Now, I'm not alcoholic, I'll say that. I wanted to belong to AA. That's what makes me absolutely qualified for Al-Anon, by the way. If Alcoholics Anonymous looks appetizing and sexy to you and you're not an alcoholic, go to the other room down the hall, okay? You're going to find your people there. But anyway, so my nickname growing up was Booze. How much more alcoholic of a nickname can you get? But did I think there was alcoholism in my family? No, but I was called Booze, so no big deal. And I just remember growing up in this environment. You know, home life was one where, I guess you could say there's a lot of danger. You know, the number of kids outnumbered the parents very quickly. But the reality is, I've learned in program, that really wasn't what I had in common with other families' members who only had maybe they were the only child and they had two parents. Because the reality is, you know, alcoholism has a way of reducing people down to prisoners of hatred and fear and resentment and shame. And in that state, they don't operate as parents very well. And my father, not an alcoholic, but who grew up, his father was alcoholic, ended up dying with a wet brain condition, but tough guy, right? A bit like a cockroach. That guy lived 20 years with a wet brain condition. Amazing. Anyway, so my dad grew up, you know, having taken on a lot of the fears and the anxieties and the guilt and the struggle of the chaos that came from that alcoholic home that he came from. And me growing up, I kind of learned how to be the awesome Al-Anonic that I became. I just took all the notches right off my dad's belt. Like, I just carried it on. And so he fell in love with my mom so powerfully that it was like, okay, well, let's see how long we can make this last. And my mother was a type who was very artistic, very fun. Little nuts, but turned out later she was prone to schizophrenia, and so that happened later. And he found that as an Al-Anonic, the only way to keep her there was to keep her pregnant. And so alcoholism is the reason I have 9 brothers and 4 sisters. No doubt about it. And it's like, when I was a kid, that was a curse because, you know, I'm the 8th child of 14, which means I'm the oldest of the second half, if you want to call it that. Just a funny way to look at it, right? I'm the 8th kid, basically. And I've got a lot of older siblings above me and no parents to stop them from pummeling me any chance they get. And since my parents had a bit of a hard hand in raising kids, because, you know, well, you're going to yell and scream and all that, because that's just how the house was growing up. I just figured that was normal. I figured if you love somebody, you fight. That's just what love is. How else do you show yourself that you really care about something? If you don't fight about it, then you must not care. That was the message I got. And so anyway, I, as a coping strategy for growing up in that big environment, I just learned to just get away. So I'd go and find places like in the backyard underneath a big pine tree, and the needles would sort of fall, and there'd be no grass there because it's just too acidic in the soil and all that. And I would bring a few of my toy cars out there, and I would just create. I'm just think of this is how Al-Anonic's mind work, okay? I go and I can do anything I want, and I build my own village, and I make up my own rules of what the cars can do and what streets they can go down, and I'm having the time of my life, isolated. So I'm practicing an Al-Anonic style of living at the age of 5. And just coping, you know. And there's no alcoholics in sight, though. Just the chaos of an alcoholic system without alcohol being present. Alcohol is so powerful, it don't need a bottle. In fact, it don't even need the alcohol. The crazy just transfers itself through relationships. That's how it does that. And so, you know, the alcoholism of my grandfather passed on. Like, my dad was a bit of a sponge. He just take on that disease, that dis-ease of an alcoholic. And then the dis-ease he felt growing up, never being treated for that, got passed on to the next sponges in line, which I was a big sponge for that. And so, you know, my mom and dad were sort of inseparable, like twins joined at the hip or something. And I would just, I saw that style of like obsessed with each other, and I figured, okay, love looks like that, that's cool. All right, just get rid of the kids thing and just be obsessed, right? Find somebody and go and be obsessed. That's a good way to relate. And anyway, my mom one day, and I got to tell this story for Joe, because I know Joe probably thinks there's just not that many people around that have wielded axes. Who, you know, certainly if they're not, Al-Anons don't do that, right? No, I got to tell Joe my axe story. So when I think I was 6, and occasionally my mom, when my dad was off to work, she'd send all the kids off to go to school, but she'd have their lonely days where she wanted to keep one behind. So that's the day that happened, and she says, Eric, I want you to stay home with me. And so She'd go do her thing, and then she'd just let me run through the neighborhood doing whatever I wanted, you know. And so I'm out in the neighborhood, and there's this other kid that I guess maybe has a mom who was lonely that day too. And we're both out in this neighborhood, and we got the neighborhood to ourselves. Only he wants it all for himself. He's like, "Who are you?" I'm like, "Where is you at school?" And I went, "My mom said I can stay at home. And I'm just playing. What's your problem?" And the kid goes, "I hate you. That's my problem." You know, like we're six. That's how kids talk, right? "I hate you because you're on my street." And I'm like, "Well, you're an idiot." And he's like, "Yeah, what are you going to do about it?" And I said, I was like, "Oh." And my little six-year-old mind thought, this guy's trying to intimidate me. Why don't I try to intimidate him? So I said to him, "I'm going to beat you up." And I was like, I'm going to beat you up. He didn't flinch at all. I was hoping he'd just run away. He didn't flinch at all. "No, you're not." I says, "No, okay, then I'm going to do one worse than that. I'm going to cut you with an axe. I'm going to cut you." Because I remember like that day when I came out from the house, I'd come out through the garage. And the garage out near the entrance of the garage is this old, beat up axe I'm sure we never used for freaking 5 years or something. And it was all rusted because it had been out in the winter and just, you know, it wasn't going to kill a flea. This kid didn't know that. And I figured, okay, I know where that axe is. And I told the kid, then you just stay here. And I went home. I picked up the axe. I'm only six, so I'm a little guy. This thing's really heavy, so I'm holding it mostly near where the steel is. And I go up to him, and I'm like, "I got the axe. You scared yet?" And he goes, "You're not going to hit me with that." And I was like, "Yes, I am." He goes, "No, you're not." Called my bluff completely. So I went up to him, and I'm going to swing this thing. I couldn't if I wanted to. And I just, he was wearing a white T-shirt, and I just touched his shoulder with the metal. And by touch, I mean there. And that kid's illusion of he wasn't in danger completely shattered. And he screamed and ran home. And as he's running home, he says, "My mom's going to get you." And I was like, "Oh." And as I run home, and I figured, I know he said something about call the cops or something. I was scared because I knew I'd done wrong. And so I run home. And I figure, okay, I got to make up an alibi here real quick. So I run upstairs, and I get under the blankets, and I knew that, you know, if you want to look like you've been sleeping, you just hyperventilate a lot. It puts a lot of friggin' red in your face. I knew all this by six. I'm not sure how I knew that. But anyway, so I'm hyperventilating like crazy, and then the cops come to our house. And my mom goes down to the door, and she opens it. And cops tell her, "Hey, you know, we're getting reports that your son's running around the neighborhood trying to hit kids with an axe." And my mom says, "Oh, is that right?" Now, she hated authority figures, cops, I guess, most of all. So she wasn't sure. She was like, "Well, wait a minute." And so she calls my name once, and I don't respond. Because you don't do that if you're asleep, right? They got to wake you up. So I'm faking it, right? And she calls me a second time. You know how it is when they call you to wake up? It's always, "Eric." It's light at first. "Eric." It's a little louder. The third one's always a scream, and that's when you wake up. And so I waited for the third scream. And she goes, "Eric." And so I, "Oh, yeah, well, I was just up here in bed." And I came down, and I'm rubbing my eyes, playing the part, you know, like trying to get away with murder here. And she goes, "Eric, were you outside playing with an axe?" "No, Mom, I was upstairs sleeping, can't you tell?" And she looked down at me and looked up, you know, I looked up at her, and we had a pact. She turned into a lion. And she started verbalizing stuff at these cops that made them turn around, hightail, get back in their cars, and never come back. And I was like, that's the day I remember being more proud of my mother than any other day in my life. Of course, protecting me from a lie. So, but it's like, you know, I had that kind of a bond with my mother when I was around six. And then eventually, you know, our family would do these things. They're so big, we tried to stay organized. And so They started doing these family kind of council meetings. And in the family council meetings, they're kind of like a group conscience. And if you've ever done a group conscience, you know how painful those are? It's like trying to herd cats or push rope. It's just really difficult to get people to participate, right? And the way that our family council would go is we'd all sit in the dining room in a circle, and each person would take a turn talking about some problem they were experiencing. And the rest of everybody, especially my parents, were supposed to, when they were done, respond with a way to work through that problem. And so I got all excited, you know, because I was having a major problem. You know, I'm six, and I have the job of washing the dishes. Now, washing the dishes, right? It shouldn't take that long, right? Not with if you're in a family my size. It would take me 3 hours at night, and I'd be in the everybody be in the living room, one wall separated from where the kitchen was, where I was, and I'd be in there washing for 3 hours and listening to them watch Dallas and laugh, or watch like episodes of Love Boat. You know what I mean? And I'm dating myself a little bit, but it's like I'm hearing them have an awesome time, and I'm in there slaving away, and I can't stand it. And you'd think on the weekends it'd get easier. No. People were gone during the week for school or work. On the weekends, everybody was always around. And so the kitchen was the most heavily trafficked place, and here I was, a six-year-old, thinking I could keep on top of all that work. I don't know why my family thought I could do that. Have you ever seen a six-year-old? You ever seen what they can actually capable of managing? Well, I thought I could. There's my Al-Anon, because he's at six. And so, it goes around, and it finally gets to me, and my complaint is not, please take this job away, I can't possibly do it. My complaint was, why do I always have to wash the dishes on Sunday? I just wanted a day off. And when I said that, it's like my eyes were saucers that had been holding back an ocean of water, and it just... like you're at one of these big theme parks, you know, and you get it right in you, right? And my heart had completely opened, and I had asked for help, thinking I might get it. And the response I got from my mother, which shocked me, was to look at me coldly and then say the words, next. I wasn't going to get any extra time off. And it was just like at that point, spiritually inside of me, one of the greatest damages that had happened to me as a human being happened. And it was this sense that, well, you know what? What's the point in letting anybody know what I want? They don't care. They're just going to, as soon as I open up that avenue and let you know what's the trouble I'm having, where I'm vulnerable, you're going to use that rope and hang me with it. I'm never letting that happen again. And so I became a shut-up pea. I didn't just isolate physically. I started to isolate every other part of me, my thinking, my feelings, my wishes, my desires. It got to a point as I got older, I didn't even know what I wanted anymore because I had compartmentalized that so long. And just believe that whatever needs I had weren't important anyway because, you know, my existence as a human being is to, I don't know, play a role of some kind. So my role in the house was to be the caretaker. And so I just kept doing my job. And but I was damaged. And, you know, I think at that moment when I was six, I became atheistic and self-reliant completely. And I wouldn't know that for 40 years. And so, you know, I went through that, and my parents' relationship, which was always rocky, when I was around 9 or 10, finally exploded. And so one of the strategies I had been using, a lot of our family members have been doing it too, is this, well, I know home's hell, but let's at least pretend when we're not at home, to look like the Partridge Family, like just to be perfect. And when my mother left my father, our family could no longer look perfect. We were a divorced family. We were a split family. And so I walked around the world thinking people could see me, see the stuff I was trying to hide completely all the time, because I couldn't pretend like we were doing great anymore. And during those years, for the 3 or 4 years, like that pain and that suffering that I went through would continue until, you know, my family, my dad remarried and we moved to this other part of the city, and we would try to kind of make a new go at things. So I went to this new neighborhood where nobody knew us, and I attempted to be cool, you know, figure out what everybody's listening to with music, buy the right clothing, say the right things at the right time, not talk about things people don't want to talk about, just fit in. And it was a really strange experience because I felt more and more isolated the older I got. And as a teenager, I didn't have the excuse, well, hey, I'm just a kid and my family's screwed up, so that's why I'm so unhappy. As a teenager, I was getting more and more freedom, and I was getting more and more unhappy and having less and less excuses to blame other people for it. Problem with using isolation as a tool to survive alcoholism, for me anyway, was that it severely handicapped me in terms of my social skills. You know, I didn't have a lot of time, you know, developing that side of myself. So dating was hell. My rules for dating, pretty funny. She had to know my name. That was kind of important, you know. She had to know my name, like me a bit, because I wasn't going after anybody unless I knew they liked me. And then they had to be cute. Dating 101, right? That's all you need to know. And so I did that and had girls crying out of relationships with me. I wasn't the one, you know, splitting off with them. They were just like, who is this guy, you know? And the reality is, you gotta just shut down my emotional center. So how can I be emotionally intimate? I had shut down how I think as well, because I don't like arguing and fighting. So I wouldn't give them any form of like intimacy. They couldn't see how I think and what I believe. So how are they supposed to relate there? The only area where I thought we could relate, of course, was physically in a sexual way. So, you know, I tried to work that angle as hard as I could as a major substitute for the rest of the ways you can be intimate. And girls just got fed up with me because I was an infant in an adolescent's body. Infant emotionally and psychologically, but physically in the body of somebody. And, you know, my sense, I had tried to do all kinds of things, both, you know, when I was just a kid and into my teens. The other thing I tried to do to try to make our family feel like it was more functional was I tried to go out and do the honorable things, right? Get really good grades. Go get a trophy for playing football, put it on your shelf at home and stuff like that. And, you know, I did my absolute best to sort of, you know, bag the lions and the elks and bring them on home for everybody to enjoy the spoils. And over any considerable period of time of my doing that, the family situation just continued to go downhill. And in my sickness, I believed that was because something was wrong with me. I don't know about you. Al-Anons think they're not too egotistical because they're thinking about the alcoholic way too much. You know, they're not thinking about themselves, but the reality is, why do we think about the alcoholics too much? Because we're thinking about how that will affect us. We are self-centered crew, too. And I was like sitting there going, you know, okay, so there are these problems and that I'm absolutely powerless over, by the way, not equipped to deal with even if I was a fully grown adult. And I'm somehow taking it personal, like I should be superhuman. And if I'm not, there's something wrong with me, like I'm defective. And what I learned in recovery was, sorry, Eric, Sounds all dramatic, I know, the way you put it, but no, you're just a human. And I'm like, just a human? Well, what do you mean by that? And they'd say, well, you're powerless to make anybody think, feel, or do anything. So if you can't do that, and there's no other human beings in the world that can do that, sorry, that doesn't make you a screw-up. That just makes you just like everyone else in the humanity. Welcome to humanity. Changed attitudes, I guess, can aid recovery, it turns out. And so I was like, oh, I had this crazy sense that I should be far more powerful over my environment than I actually am. And of course, my parents fostered that idea. They were looking for as much help to help them as possible and didn't mind turning it over to the kids. And so, you know, for me, it was like, somebody once asked me, when did alcoholism affect you? When did it start affecting you, Eric? You know, and I'd been to open AA meetings where guys would say, I started drinking when I was 12, so I figured my emotional state stunted at about 12. And I remember hearing that and going, you're a 40-year-old in a 12-year-old in a 40-year-old body? That's pathetic. But now they're asking me, when did it start for me? And if I was totally honest with myself, it would have to be the day that I came back from the hospital. Because that was the day the environment of an alcoholic, an Al-Anonic, if you want to call it that, environment started to have its influences on me. And I realized, who am I to hold a torch against a member of AA who only started to stunt their growth at 12 when I did it, when it happened to me at like 1. And I realized that for me, recovery is a process of growing up again. And I literally had to grow up again. Because I didn't do any growing up when I was a kid. And in Al-Anon, they give you a safe environment to learn how to do that. And a safe environment is just an environment where it's okay to make mistakes. In an alcoholic home, it's never okay to make mistakes. But in an Al-Anon environment, you have to learn to make mistakes and then learn from them. That's the only way we grow. And so, you know, I did a lot of that, and just working through my life, and eventually I'm looking for the shortcut, easy way into a relationship. And I discovered in my inventory work, one of the simplest but most deadly shortcuts to doing a relationship is, well, you kind of know what's going on inside of you a little bit, like you know what you want. You know what you don't want. You have a sense of what you are and all that. So just pretend everybody else is just like you. They probably want what you want. They probably think the way that you think. But the reality, and I attempted to live that way for a lot of years. And of course, I had a lot of people just going, what do you think I want that for? I don't want that. I don't want that at all. I want this. And I would fight with them and say, no, you don't, because you're just like me. Well, I wouldn't say that, but that's what I would assume. And it wasn't until I came into Al-Anon that I realized, oh, no, I got to be more realistic. I got to accept that all human beings actually are different, which means I got to be open-minded about what a person might want or feel or do and never assume any of that. It's a lot of hard work. It's kind of messy to do that, you know. I can't expect people to just read my mind. It's that old, they're just like me, so they should be able to figure out me. That magical, they can read my mind business. I had to get rid of that insanity. And I had to ask people what they wanted when I didn't know. And I had to tell people what I needed. I had to learn to do that again. I could only do that in Al-Anon rooms. First starting with men, because I was so emotionally scarred by women in my life, and men too, that the men hurdle was a little easier to get over at first. And in a way, that was a really powerful experience for me, because part of growing up, I had ended up, you know, my dad was pretty tough, come out of the military, so he kind of raised us like we were in boot camp and stuff. Mostly they figure out what you've done wrong, and they tell you all about it, or they scold you, or they punish you. And so I, being the Al-Anonic I am, wanted to get out front of that. I wanted to take that control away from them. And I didn't do this consciously, but it happened. I just adopted a critical part of my mind that was even harder on me than my dad ever would be. And I would allow that part of me to do the scolding so that I could become this perfect human being that my father couldn't find fault with. And the problem with that strategy is that member of my committee in my head didn't leave when I left home. It stayed. And I ended up being far harder on myself than anyone else ever was. And so I had to drop this whole, woe is me because everybody's been so hard on me act. Because, come on, Eric, who's harder on you than you? And if you're going to hate yourself for that, how's that going to help you get any better? You've got to take another path. And so I discovered, you know, okay, well, I got to let go of that. I guess, you know, my sponsor had told me at one point when we're doing this, like, four-step stuff, he goes, hey, Eric, you know, I noticed you judge people a lot. Now, he said it with so much love, I couldn't be angry at him. He's like, yeah, you just judge people all the time, don't you? And I'm like, do I? He goes, every chance you get. He says, you don't have to see them coming anymore. You're safe. You're loved. And I just remember thinking, like, okay, well, let me just, he goes, and then your judgment of yourself is horrible. Like, the first offsite that I went to, I'm there and my head is caving in. You know, I'm leaving a marriage I'd been in for about 13 years. By leaving, meaning I was given the door again, and I was so devastated by that because I had no other plans for living. Everything had failed, and so I went back to being that kid, isolating in the backyard, hoping nobody will notice what I'm going through at a convention. I love the. You know, if you're in a 12-step program and you're not working it, that's insane. You know, that's insanity. Because I was going to this offsite doing just that. The man that would become my sponsor, Jack C. from Sillmore, he was there, and he kind of has, like, the sponsors are awesome, really good ones especially. They have X-ray vision like Superman. They can see what's going on. He took one look at me and he says, your head's caving in, isn't it? Of course, I didn't answer back. I didn't want to acknowledge that. But yeah, he was right. He goes, you know, if you don't open up and tell us what's going on, we can't help you. So I love the message, you know, that Joe gave. Like, if you want to live long and be happy, you should probably get real with somebody. Get honest with somebody. And I wasn't ready to do that yet. Until I had lost all the energy left in me to fight that old battle. And then I told those guys in that offsite how much I hated men, how much I didn't trust them, how much they'd abused me over the years, my brothers and, you know, different people in my life. And I was like, yeah, so I don't trust any of you. Dirty, rotten scoundrels. I don't even know how I got up here and let somebody drive me. I should have driven myself so I could have left when I wanted, you know. I felt like held hostage, and I said to them, and I said to them all, I told them all this, and I said, and here's why. And I told them about it, an incident with my dad. His sort of wonderwall left him. He was alone. You know, he had sort of hoped that my mother would restore him to sanity, and he didn't have a higher power. And in that moment, he lost it one night when I didn't do the dishes on time. And sort of mopped me up, used me to mop up the whole kitchen one night. Just got violent, terrible. And I said, so yeah, I don't trust that men won't abuse me at some point if I open up. I can't do that. But you see, I just had. I had just told 52 men about that. And those 52 men, you know what they did? After they allowed me to finish that three-minute share, and that was a long 3 minutes, I'm sure, for some of them, they all jumped into the air afterwards, clapping. Woo-hoo! Eric just discovered the power of being honest and the recovery that can come from it. He's in. They loved me for being that way. And I was just like, whoa, that's a different experience. And when that happened to me, something else shifted inside of me. I didn't realize it till later. But I loved. I went from being afraid of all men to loving those 52 guys with all my heart. And they gave me this hope, this feeling of, well, they've been through just as bad as me, and they are lovable. I don't think I am, but now I see 52 guys that are lovable, so I know guys are lovable. Maybe I can be lovable too. That's a huge spiritual move for me. And so, you know, when I got into program, basically, every avenue that I had tried to go down, all these ways, these strategies I had devised on my own, which, terrible ideas, by the way, but it's amazing how my ego doesn't want to listen to anybody else's ideas because it thinks all mine are great, right? But eventually, I start to learn to become open. I gain hope by being open-minded because I hear other people's experience. And I start to see that they've transformed, and so maybe that'll work for me too. So I'll take those next steps. And I started doing that, and what happened was I discovered I loved men. Maybe if I can love men, I think men are lovable, I could understand why women would love them. Why women might love me. And it started to open the door for me to stop being so shut up and isolated away from the women in program. And no, I didn't go straight to step 13. I'm too shy that way. But it was like I started to open up and discovered the beauty of women's recovery in Al-Anon. You know, I kind of grew up without a mom. And my sisters were just sort of battle axe, you know, Viking type women. And so, you know, I'd been longing for love and comfort and nurturing sort of supportive energy. And I started to discover that the women in Al-Anon who had found their way past their resentments and fear of men were the ones who were willing to be my surrogate moms and my surrogate sisters. And today I have so many. The big family that I grew up in, that was so chaotic, is now the huge worldwide fellowship of Al-Anon. I've got honorary uncles and aunts, and you know, after our Thursday night meeting, we like to go and fellowship a little bit. And there's this brand new guy that was there last Thursday. And we were outside as this group after the meeting, and we were talking, and we were laughing our hinds off. And this was after we just had some weird meeting about, is it God, or is this odd, or is this God? You know, we were joking, we were like saying things like, is it odd, is it God, or is it just a dog? You know, like, and we're laughing outside, rolling on the floors, like, with that stuff. And he had told me a little bit beforehand that his family are really vicious fighters. And he has a hard time staying out of that. But there he is in this fellowship setting, and I'm looking at this, you know, crap-eating grin on his face, which I hadn't seen before. And I said to him, what's going on, man? And he goes, this is awesome. It feels just like family. And I reminded him, Al-Anon isn't a program, but the Al-Anon family groups is. Al-Anon's just a nickname. The actual full name of our program is Family, the Al-Anon Family Groups. And so if you haven't found that family of a home group, you're not getting all Al-Anon can give you. So go after that and get it. Anyway, so I get into program, and the marriage goes away. You know, we weren't compatible to begin with in the first place, but so at least we could start to get honest about that. I have a more intimate relationship with my former wife now than I did when we were married for 13 years, and we only talk every other couple of years. Like it's really amazing. I remind her, how grateful I am to have been married to her and have everything happen exactly the way it happened. And, our marriage had sort of started as a lot of fun. And then it was a lot of fun with some fights, and then it was like just fun with fights until the end it just became fights. And so it was pretty hard on us, and we'd gone through that. And so I'd left feeling pretty bitter. And today, when I talk to her, I'm always grateful because I think to myself, okay, in my inventory process, I had to learn to accept me exactly the way that I am. And part of accepting me meant that I had to realize I'm a major hard case. Like, I ain't going in to get recovery. I don't want it. I don't want to do the work. I'm atheistic, so I don't want to do any of the prayers. I don't want to talk about God. I don't want to do any of this stuff. I'm tired of it all. I want somebody to just take care of me for a change, because I've been doing too much taking care of others. And I'd come to realize that instead I was this person who's so hard-headed and had this incredibly high tolerance for pain. Massive amounts of it. I mean, I've been put through a lot of it. You might say I got tempered as a child, but and then out in life, I tested that tempering to see just how much bashing I could take. And I could take a lot, and I was very proud of that. Tough, eh? Oh, I'm tough, Like it's an asset. I've learned what it means. Tough is not an asset. Tough is a resistance. It's closed-mindedness. But anyway, I was tough, eh? And it was going to take an incredibly large amount of pain. So I'm not going to, by principle, take on this stuff. But pain is a taskmaster that very few of us fail to obey when the pain threshold gets high enough. And for me, that threshold was so high, it took having a schizophrenic mother, an Al-Anonic father, the chaos and dysfunction of a family of 14 that should have been split up and cut up into a million pieces and sent off to social services, to a marriage that almost killed me. It took all of that to crack through my denial and get me to a place where I was a little bit willing to try something I have never done before. And so I think of my mother and all the stuff that happened between us and my dad, and I think of all my siblings and all the bad, and I go, oh, that's just what it took to crack this nut. So I'm eternally grateful I didn't have really awesome family members when I was younger, because I maybe would have never passed that threshold and never joined you guys in this recovery business. I would have been that sick, self-righteous, dominating guy until I was in my 90s and died away, like so many do. And anyway, so I get into the whole working a program stuff and sponsoring and all that stuff, and I discover, I hit that, do the first step, am I powerless over alcohol? Sure. My life unmanageable, okay. Is there a power greater than me? Well, I guess if I jump up, gravity will pull me back down. I can't get myself up, so that's a power greater than me. There's a power out there. And, you got a higher, okay, so now, if a higher power could restore you to sanity, then how about you make a decision to turn over your will in your life? And I was like, okay, I could do that to that power that's greater than me. And I get into doing the fourth step, and it's like, oh, it almost kills me. And so what I do instead is I just sit there with, I think I tried the Blueprints for Progress, and Other people have said really good things about that, had good experiences with it, and I've learned everybody's different, so that's okay. I tried it, it didn't work at all. It wasn't going to work for me, and so then I went into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and did the column method, and I found I spent way too much time thinking about who they are, what they did, and why it affected me so badly, and I got so depressed and so, like, broken from that that it took me 6 years to get about three-quarters of the way through that. And then I broke. And then I'd pick the new sponsor, and that sponsor says, "Hey, Eric, you're changing sponsors. What are you changing sponsors for?" And he says, "Well, I have this problem, and I love what you shared at the meeting, but I can't seem to get past this four step. I think what I need to do is finally get past that somehow." And he says, "No, that's not what you need at all." And I get frustrated. I'm just like, "Come on, man, I'm trying here." And he says, "Well, I got to tell you this." "What?" He goes, "You need a new experience. And you need one bad, and you need it quick." And I go, "What's that? What's new? What's this progress thing?" He goes, "Yeah, well, that means you got to do something you haven't done before. And see, it's not the answer isn't in your head. So you've got to get it from somebody else." You know, I had been up to that point reading all the literature, so I don't have to ask you what to do. I just figured I'd cheat. Textbook answers are right there for you at the literature table, right? And it turns out, no, I can't work a program without a sponsor and a higher power and a home group. Like, I thought I could just do it in isolation. And what happened instead, he goes, "So no, we're going to give you a different method to do it." It's just a big, long questionnaire written by a long-timer in Al-Anon who's from the South. And when you're done answering this questionnaire, it's going to have overturned and looked at every possible nook and cranny in your life. And when you're done, you'll have a life sketch. And he said, "The whole point of doing that inventory, by the way, is come up with four lists. It's not so, you're not going in there to figure out what you got to fix." He says, "Get that out of your head. You're not going in there to fix nothing. You're just collecting data about your life." And so I was like, "Okay, well, what are these lists you're talking about?" He goes, "Well, you got to have a list of defects and a list of shortcomings. You got to have a list of assets, and then you need a list of people you think you may have harmed. Those are all going to come in handy for the steps that come after." And so I said to him, "Okay, all right, what's a defect? I kind of think I know what that is, but I'm not sure 100%. And he goes, "A defect is something that's really totally useless. You can live without it. Like when you broke a tire on the road. What's the point in trying to ride on that broken tire anymore? You got to get rid of it and replace it." He says, "That's a defect." And then he says, "What's the difference between a defect and a shortcoming?" And he said to me, he goes, "Well, a shortcoming is when you have a little bit of something, but not quite enough. So if you're impatient, for instance, well, you got some patience, but it doesn't last you long enough, and you need more. That's a shortcoming." And, when Bill Wilson, by the way, said, "Oh, they're the same thing," I think what he meant was they both block you from the sunlight of the Spirit. Lack of development. Like, all these areas where I'm shortcoming are all the areas where I'm underdeveloped. And later I'll discover those are the amends I have to make to myself. It's a lifetime journey of growing up and developing those muscles. And so he goes, "Yeah, so that's what a shortcoming is. And oh, by the way, you know what the assets are?" I'm like, "Yeah, those are the good things." "Yeah, how many good things do you think you got?" "Well, I don't know, but I got a lot of defects and shortcomings for sure." He goes, "Well, no problem. All of your shortcomings are assets hidden. If you're impatient, it means you have some patience, and you don't want to let go of that. You want to build on that. So you have to put into your assets that you have some patience, you know? Or if you have low self-esteem, well, it doesn't mean you have none, right? So you have to put into your asset level, well, I got some self-esteem, not very much, right? We got to build that. And what that did is it got me out of this in my head. The balance on the sheet was, okay, defects high, shortcomings really high, assets almost none, and then people I've harmed, anybody I've ever met. That's not very realistic. And so, you know, I have a little chat with my guys before they start that process, and I tell them, let's get real about defects. You're probably going to think, when I finished my list, I had 121 of them. And 6 assets, and my sponsor looked at me and says, Eric, you're not supposed to use program to hurt yourself. I said, I thought I was being rigorously honest. That's just how, you know, I practice a program in my isolation. I'm just clueless. And he said, let's get real about those defects. You only have 5. You can only have 5 because that's all there are. And I'm like, yeah, right. That doesn't sound right at all. 5? You're cheating. That's what I thought. There's got to be more than that. And then he shows me the AA morning prayer out of the big book. You know, the first line of which says something along the lines, God, divorce from my thinking, self-pity, dishonesty, self-will, self-seeking, and fear. Now, I'd been divorced, so I kind of know what that means. Jeez, that's a lot of work. And when you're done, you sign it on the paper, like you do it. And it meant divorce, meaning it's out. I'm not going to live my life based on that kind of, those kinds of energy in my life. And then he sat me down and he would explain to me, okay, now what does it mean to have self-pity? So because if you're going to spot this kind of stuff, you're going to spot a defect like that, you better know what it is. And he says, it's just a thinking error. And the thinking goes something like this. You're thinking about what you don't have. Anybody here spent any insignificant time thinking a little bit about what they don't have? Or is that just dangerous thinking territory? If their brain was empty of that kind of thinking, that'd be a good thing. And so I was like, okay, now thinking about what I don't have, that's self-pity, okay. So dishonesty, well, we'll go to that one last. And then there's self-will, what's that? What does that really mean? Give it to me in basic English. Just thinking only about what I want. That's what, my will is what I want. And self-will means I'm only thinking about what I want. How many of you can get into a headspace where all you're thinking about is what you want, and that goes well for you? Like you're at work. Oh, I don't care what my boss wants today. I'm only thinking about what I want, which is to, you know, snack on some cookies and watch the rest of this movie while I work at home, right, remotely with a mouse mover going like this so they think I'm working. That's what I want. Oh, and paycheck better be big, right? Because, geez, what do I have to put myself through to work for that boss? I've earned it, you know, like all these specifications and stuff. So anyway, self-will, just thinking only about what I want. And then the self-seeking is the next one, and it's thinking about how to get what you want, your plans. And, of course, if it's self-seeking, then it means you're only thinking about how to get what you want. How many people have ever spent some quality time doing that and, like, just dominated the world with that kind of thinking? No, it's just that kind of thinking destroys my relationships big time. Very inconsiderate. And the last one was fear. And I thought I'd lick this one. I knew fear was just this thing that gripped you in your body and it didn't leave you until it was done with you. That's all I thought it was. And he goes, no, that's what your body's reaction is to your thinking about, thinking behind fear. So what is the thinking? And it's like, well, the answer's right in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the fear inventory section. You know, where it's like, why didn't our plans, you know, work to resolve fear? I think I'm paraphrasing it really badly. But Bill Wilson says, well, wasn't it because our self-reliance had failed us? And if you reverse engineer the thinking behind that, it's like, well, if I'm relying only on me to get this done and it's not enough, I must be thinking it's all up to me to solve my problem. So I tell guys, oh yeah, when you're looking for fearful thinking, it's the thinking, I have a problem and it's all up to me to solve it. That's not very realistic either. Because it's not. There's plenty of help. There's a higher power in this business. Fellowship. There's all kinds of stuff that's available. And so those are the defects. Those are things we can just live without. And then there's the, you know, we'd figured out what those are. And then when we go through the inventory, instead of trying to figure out what it is they're trying to, like, fix or solve, I tell them, oh, no, we're not here to fix or solve anything. This isn't psychology. You're not trying to understand why you and your dad are, like, self-centered. Like, that doesn't help any of our recovery. What helps is you just look at any of those situations where you see your defects at play. So in that scenario where you're talking about, you know, growing up as a kid and you were isolating Eric as a kid out in the backyard, who put a gun to your head and said you had to do that? Do you see how your self-will may have driven you there? Well, I want to be safe. Nobody's going to help me be safe, so I'm going to go out in the back. That's my self-seeking method. And he goes, yeah. What would have happened? What could have happened if it were different? If those kinds of problems in your life were removed, could your life have transformed and been different? Yeah. If I wasn't sitting there thinking about what I don't have, enough safety. If I wasn't thinking about, you know, how to get away from, get that isolation that I wanted and be safe and all that, I might have just gone to the neighbor's house and played with a kid. So I help guys that way, and I give them, when they're writing their inventory, I give them one of those old kitchen timers, you know, where you can just set it for 10 minutes, and then it'll just reset itself once 10 minutes is done. Most of them don't have a clue what they're feeling because they've locked themselves down for so long. That's certainly how it was for me. So I had to learn how to, and feelings have a lot of energy. They can get you tired quick. And when you're doing that four-step writing, what happens to most people is they come into it and they go, and I did this too, oh, I'm going to get it all done this weekend. Yep, I can do it. Let's just rip all the scabs off tonight. You know, let's have a nice self-pity party on Saturday, and then I'll be talking about this with my sponsor on Sunday, and it'll all be done, like the big push. That's probably what killed the Donner Party, right? So it's like, no wonder I was in so much pain attempting to do it all at once, because I had no skills for, what do you call it, like when you pace yourself. Like some of you hike, right? And you know, when you get out onto a hillside or a mountainside, you've got to think about how many miles you've got. You got to think about how much water you have. You got to think about, you know, did you get good enough sleep last night? Like, how much energy do you really have to work with that day? And then you got to think about the climbs and how much energy that will take, and you pace yourself so that when you're doing it, you can try to enjoy the hike. Well, you can actually use that same skill when you're doing your four-step. And this is how you do it. It's really simple. You get one of those stupid kitchen timers. Because those stupid kitchen timers are a better pacer than you are. And it certainly worked for me. And my sponsor says, okay, you set it for 10 minutes and you're going to write for 10 minutes. And when that beeper goes off, your pen goes down. It doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a sentence. And you're just going to ask yourself to look inside of yourself and ask yourself, how much energy do you have left? Do you think you could do another 10 minutes? And if the answer is honestly yes, they do another 10 minutes until the 10-minute beeper goes off and until they know they've got no more. They can't do another 10 minutes. And then I tell them, you don't ever write every day. That's ridiculous. You know, you've got to give your heart and your mind time to heal from each time you bring back up the emotional stuff that you've been burying. And you also have to give God some time to heal you. Because you're bringing that up. You go every day. It's kind of like going to the gym, working your upper body every day, and then you're hating your life for going to the gym that way. Be good. God, give you time to heal so you see the benefits from that. And so I tell them, just use those timers, and you go every other day. Whether you feel good or not, you can always do 10 minutes. And this long inventory process that, you know, the shorter ones that had taken me more than 6 years to do only took me about 6 months to do. With this other method. and with guys that were in incredible pain, what I would do is, because the inventory has like different sections in your life, it'll have like, you know, 0 to 12 years, and then adolescence, and then several sections for your adult life. I would tell them, well, if it's really, really painful for you to write, let's do the fourth and fifth step together. I don't really mean at the same time, because you can't. But you can tandem them. So I'd say, let's do your childhood section. If you can just write on that, then give that to me as your fifth step. And then they start to see some of the benefits that come from having done the work, and that encourages them to get through the rest of it. And we just take it in manageable blocks like that. You know, and the average person that comes into Al-Anon, a lot of them leave because they're just here sometimes just to feel better. And then after their problem's gone away, maybe they had a divorce, so they think the alcoholic's gone. And there goes their alcoholism, the family disease with it. No, but they think that, so they take off for a while, and then they come back when they're on their knees or whatever. Is they come in and they leave, and then some guys, what they'll do is they come in and they attempt to do what they think Al-Anon is, and then they fail to be able to do it, so they think it's a program that they're not able to do. And they walk away more broken by that Al-Anon experience than they came in with. And I think it's because, you know, that can happen. You give somebody this Mount Everest experience and think that they should just be able to manage their way through it themselves. No. The average number of guys in our group that do their steps is higher than I think some areas. You know, I think there's probably, 15 to 20%? I think the average in Al-Anon is maybe 5% of people in Al-Anon actually have done their inventory work and done a fourth and fifth step. Let's not talk about ninth step. That's even narrower. But it's like with the guys that I sponsor using this simple method, I have a 90% success rate. And it's funny how, like, walking them through the process, and I would meet with them once a week. They'd come to my house. I'd treat them like family. That's what they are to me. We'd sit down and we'd walk through that, a piece of their inventory, and then they'd go away for the week, and they'd come back the next week, and we'd do some more. All of them have said, you know, like, wow, this whole fourth and fifth oogity-boogity scary step isn't that hard. I says, well, no, you just need some structure around it so that you can pace yourself through it, because, geez, if you've been holding down all your emotions all your life, those got to come back up. You know, it's an uncovering, discovering process, and if you've buried down a lot of emotions, you got to get equipped with that. And so part of the inventory process, I would help these guys. What I would tell them is, like, give me their answer to a particular question. And you're not supposed to just say what happened. Like, so if the question were, you know, what's the longest relationship you've been in? And they would say, when I was married. And then I'd say to them, well, how do you feel about that? And they would just go blank. They don't understand emotions. They don't understand the words for it. So I'd have to give them a little bit of coaching on that, because, I was given some coaching. I was given a cheat sheet. I'd go through those feelings. And so they'd have some words to describe what they felt. And wouldn't you know, I'm going to finish with this. Wouldn't you know that they would start to, they'd do it badly at first until they could get better. And they could start to, like, recognize the emotions a couple of weeks later after they had them, and then eventually they'd start to be able to label their emotions in real time. And then they would start to go to places with their emotions they didn't think were possible. They'd start to recognize trends with their emotions, patterns. Oh, when I'm scared, I get angry, because I look at how good it feels to be angry, better than feeling afraid. I'd tell them, well, your real problem isn't the anger then, is it? It's the fear. You got to get down to the harder feelings to feel. And so they'd start to learn to stratify their feelings and get down to the core ones. And guess which feeling is the absolute hardest feeling to feel? Some would say fear. Some would say confusion. Some would say, I hate feeling shame or guilt. Those are really terrible. But all of them agree wholeheartedly that the hardest feeling to have and process is the one they have the biggest problem with. And it's talked about in step one right up front. When you feel powerless. And so I help these guys, like, it takes a long time to work through that process, but it's that chance for them to start growing up, understanding what feelings they have and how to communicate them in real time and develop that side. They're already doing amends by the time they're finished their fifth step. That's why when we're done, they're launched into, like, amends and things like that that bring a transformation that's incredible. And, the end result is essentially men that feel more courage to be vulnerable in their relationships than they ever felt before, because they know what they feel. They're not scared about that, you know, empty, dark place anymore. And then there's this feeling of, when you know your feelings, then you'll start to know why you do what you do. Because, I mean, motives are just our emotions. See how close those words are? And so they know their emotions that drive them to do things. They know what their motives are. And knowing their inner mechanisms better and knowing when they need their higher power to step in, they start to gain that wisdom of when they can do something for themselves and when they can't. And that starts to build this feeling of integrity within a person that transforms their lives. I see it happen. And I think the best step in recovery to continually, once you've worked through them all, to do is to grab that baton and be a sponsor and give away everything that you've got. It's the only way to keep it. And the only reason why I got anything that I got is because someone in AA did it first and handed it away to the family members. So we could do it too. So I'm grateful for AA, grateful for all you people here in recovery, and I'm grateful for my life today. It's huge. That's what I got to say. Thanks so much for letting me share.